This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, Michael McKenzie here. Today, how we feel about ourselves, our bodies, and the food we put into them after the widespread restrictions and isolations of last year. And we introduce you to a term coined by our first guest. Be ready as we discuss what this medico calls Nutribolics. Welcome to Life Matters. New research shows one in three Australians have gained weight during the pandemic, and there's been a lot of talk about COVID kilos in social media, that it's likely all of us could be feeling a little vulnerable at the moment when it comes to the latest fad diet or superfood craze to hit our news feeds. Have you tried, by the way, some version of dieting during and after the worst of COVID? If so, what worked or didn't? Or have you deliberately not used a diet at all? Tell me what action you've taken or not via text. The number is 0418 226 576. That is 0418 226 576. So how do we wade through all this Nutribolics, as my guest today calls it, and come out the other end feeling better about our health and our bodies? Dr. Josh Woolrich is an NHS surgical doctor in the UK who decided to study nutrition to plug the gaps he saw in his own medical training. Josh is the author of a new book called Food Isn't Medicine, Challenge Nutribolics and Escape the Diet Trap. And Josh Woolrich, welcome to Life Matters.
Hello, Michael. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good, but I need to ask us to define some terms. Can we start by defining, of course, that well-known medical term, Nutribolics?
Oh, I think it's a great word. I mean, in the UK, we use the word bollocks to mean nonsense. And so Nutribolics is essentially just spurious nutrition information that I'm sure many of us have come across on a daily basis. Things like statements like carbs make you fat, things like sugar causes cancer, you know, juicing can cure cancer. Any of that kind of stuff falls under that kind of bracket.
And sadly, I have to say, a lot of that kind of black and white statement of intent often comes from social media influencers and people with a lot of money and maybe not much medical advice or training.
Yeah, I think they're definitely one group of people that that cause a lot of harm. I mean, there are several groups here. There's the misguided healthcare professionals that I talk about quite a lot. There's the snake oil salespeople, and then there are the well-meaning celebs. And I think social media has definitely given a platform to people to speak about this topic with some form of authority, which may not have been necessarily gained, but leads to them having a real risk of misleading an awful lot of people, far more than they would have been able to do, say, 10, 15 years ago.
Well, if we get time, I'd love to, in a very short space, hear from you about your marvelous relationship with Justin Bieber. But we'll get to that hopefully later. What do you see also as the diet trap? Because surely I come back to you and say a diet is a form of food intake. And if we're on the wrong kinds of food intake, that can affect our long-term health. So why is dieting necessarily a trap?
Sure. Well, I mean, so I don't deny the fact that food can have a really big impact on our health, but I think we need to have this stuff in context. So, I mean, my book, The Food Isn't Medicine, it's a campaign, essentially. It's my campaign to push back against these underlying messages that food can cure you if you just find the right diet. This is a really common thing. These are completely false promises. But at the same time, they often link our health to our weight. And this is another big topic that I talk about quite a lot in the book. And this whole thing makes eating just incredibly stressful. And I want people to have a more relaxed attitude. I mean, we all have a relationship with food. We all eat on a day-to-day basis. We all eat at least usually three times a day. It's something that we need to start paying attention to. And at the same time, realizing that our weight does not define our health. And again, those two are so linked when it comes to our diet. And I think it can be very easy to take the word diet and go, well, it just means this. It just means the food we actually choose to put on our plate, or the food that we find we are able to put on our plate, because choose is another word that is an interesting one if we've got time. But I think we need to realize that when people are talking about diet, the vast majority of the time, this has an element of weight loss or weight gain associated with it. And so people are talking about diet in regards to dieting. I really wish we could go back to just talking about diet from a nutrition standpoint. But again, we then come back into the whole food isn't medicine stuff. And even then, we've started to have a lot of the wellness industry start to play on people's perceptions of what health is, to trick them into undergoing certain things that once was sold on a weight loss promise and now is being sold on a health promise. Intermittent fasting is a very, very common example of that.
Well, let's talk about that if you'd like to, just briefly, because Michael Moseley, who has been one of the chief proponents of intermittent fasting based on the science journalism he's done with various researchers around the world, says that, you know, the science is definitely there, that it backs up that not only can you lose weight on that, but as an equal amount of the priority for intermittent fasting is that it also improves cellular repair. And there is some evidence emerging that it might be great for reestablishing good neural pathways in the brain. You're not an advocate?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that we need to talk about here. Firstly, Michael Moseley is just one of many people. He's not really the problem. He's kind of the example of an issue that we have. Look, when it comes to weight loss and when it comes to any sort of diet plan or fad, and yes, intermittent fasting does fall under that kind of category, it's no different to anything else. This is a way of eating that people use to restrict their energy intake, right? In regards to its sustainability, in regards to whether or not this is something that actually resolves in any sort of long-term change in your body weight, there's no evidence that it's any better than anything else. And people that tell you that it is, unfortunately, are almost always trying to sell you their version of that plan. Be that the 800 fast diet or whatever that his book is specifically called, or anything else along those lines from anybody else who is selling you something along those. This kind of thing is often missed out. If you ask those questions to these people, they say, oh, no, but my version changes that and my version is better. None of it's true. When it comes to things in regards to cellular regeneration, there's really interesting research around that kind of stuff, but none of that is in humans. And I think that's really, really important to point out. We actually don't have a good way of measuring any sort of cellular regeneration when it comes to fasting in our body. And so a lot of this stuff is all hypothetical, and we're basing this on things like mice research, which is fun from a scientific perspective, but it's not a good argument to be telling people to essentially, and I'll be as strong as I can with this, starve themselves, because that's what this is. If you take away the claims of wellness, if you take away the claims of health, you're telling people to skip meals. You're telling people to drastically, depending on what kind of intermittent fasting you're advising, you're telling people to drastically reduce their calorie intake one day, no matter whether they're hungry, no matter whether they are necessarily feeling good doing that. This is something that we just don't talk about. We are so obsessed and we have such a focus on weight loss being the goal and being the pinnacle of our health, we find it, we use it as an excuse to justify our disordered eating. And skipping meals, refusing to eat when we're hungry because it's not our time to eat, because we've made a certain rule for ourselves that during the day I'm only allowed to eat between these hours, it's not healthy for us. It's very, very hard to argue that this thing is good for both our physical or our mental health.
Well, you argue that when it comes to nutrition as well, health professionals have a lot to learn from nutritionists themselves. Is that correct?
Yeah, 100%. I think we have a real problem, and I think this is a global issue as well, where doctors tend to want to learn from other doctors. Whether or not that's actually the best people to learn from, and I know that might sound slightly hypocritical now that I've written a book as a doctor, but the thing is here is that I really believe that we should be learning more about nutrition in medical school. I do think that that's the case, but I'm very concerned about who it is that is teaching this kind of stuff. Because unfortunately, the way that we learn about medicine is in a way that doesn't actually nicely correspond to learning about nutrition. They're two very different scientific disciplines, and they're things that we just don't really understand as doctors. And we believe that our skills and our training is very easily transferable. And it leads us to think that nutrients can act like drugs. Hence the title of the book, Food Isn't Medicine. It directly challenges some of that kind of stuff and also talks about why that kind of attitude can be so harmful. So yeah, I really do think that we need to be listening to people who are actually trained in this kind of stuff. It's one of the reasons why I specifically have taken time out from the hospital work to study this as a master's, because I don't want to be straying out of my lane. I want to be respectable in regards to the way that I'm talking about these topics and paying attention to the fact that I need to learn a new discipline. I think we need to, as doctors in general, need to stop letting our ego get in the way a little bit there, the topic.
Yeah, well, Josh, we've actually brought in a nutritionist into this conversation. I'd like to welcome Dr. Tim Crowe. That's right. Tim is an accredited practicing dietitian, co-author of Understanding Nutrition, which is the leading text used in nutrition and dietetics courses in Australia and New Zealand. Tim, hello. Welcome to this conversation.
Hello, Michael. Thanks for having me on. Great to chat about this fascinating topic. And hello, Josh.
I think it's morning, isn't it, Tim? I apologize. It's just after midnight for me, so I was trying to work out the right word there.
It is morning here. It is morning here, which means, of course, we're all on the first stage of our intermittent dieting there, Josh. Tim, I wanted to ask you, as a person who's literally written the book on nutrition here in Australia, does much of what Josh is promulgating here today ring true for you? Are there issues around the way doctors talk about weight management, diet and nutrition in this country?
I think Josh and I will be singing very much from the same song sheet. I was nodding along with everything he had to say. There's a lot of truth in that. Nutrition is quite seductive, that we all eat and food affects us differently, and that's valid. But from that, your own personal experience doesn't mean you've got the expertise to advise millions of people of your followers of how to eat to lose weight or to control diabetes or so on. So the fundamentals of nutrition actually have been fairly constant over the decades. It's all the tweaking and playing with and the superfoods and the nutrients and the clean eating and all the fads that come and go over decades that really confuses the public about what is a healthy way to eat, because everyone has different buy-ins and different commercial interests in promoting their message.
So who should we believe? Why should we believe you and Josh?
So with nutrition, we look at the science and that evolves over time. But if you look at the fundamentals that show what is the key dietary patterns that are linked to good long-term health, ready to be followed by this, it's going to be a diet that's mostly full of plant-based foods, minimally processed fruits, vegetables, grains, legumes. And if you choose to, you can add in some dairy and some meat. That type of dietary pattern, and I use the word dietary pattern, some decades ago we were trained in talking about nutrients. And nutrients are great to study, the science of nutrition, but nobody eats nutrients, we eat foods. And dietary patterns or dietary themes are much more powerful predictors of long-term health. So you forget the foods right and the nutrients take care of themselves.
Well, in some ways, Tim, aren't you describing in part what makes up seemingly the science-backed improvements in our dietary lifestyle if we adopt a Mediterranean-style diet? That is a diet full of olive oils and nuts and legumes and fresh fruit and vegetables, some meat, not much, often a little bit of fish is not a bad thing. If we go for that kind of Mediterranean approach to eating, that in itself is a diet. Why can't we yes, go ahead. What were you going to say?
Yes, it's a diet as in a way of eating, as Josh was saying, rather than diet.
Yes.
To lose weight, very different, yep.
Okay, so there's different definitions of what diet means here. Josh, would you agree with that? That in fact, you can say the Mediterranean diet is a great way to make sure your income of nutrients within the food choices you make is appropriate. But it's when you use the word diet as here's a new way that's never been thought of before and that'll cost you $40. That's what you're worried about.
Yeah, I mean, the Mediterranean dietary pattern is amazing, and the nutrients that tends to give the body, or the way that tends to allow us to eat, is brilliant and is incredibly healthy for us. But we need I'm really passionate about the fact that we need to start separating this choice of the pattern in which we eat and the way that our body looks. Rather than trying to associate everything with some sort of weight loss goal, I think it does a real disservice to what food really can do and just how good food can be for us. Because the problem is that it creates this context of shame, guilt, and failure. And we can do this with exercise, we can do this with food. If we're only choosing to start following something because we believe it's going to cause us to be thinner, because that's the goal, let's be honest, it's not really about health for a large majority of the time. I know it wasn't for me when I was stuck in cycles of doing this kind of stuff. It's all about what we look like. And when the diet that we've gone on doesn't really change that, or it changes it but temporarily, and then 6 months later, nothing's really changed, we believe that that diet wasn't healthy, in quotes, for us. And it's a real shame, because we're missing out on a lot of stuff, and we're starting to pick what foods we should eat based on their promises when it comes to weight. And food is so much more exciting than that. Food is so much better for us than that. Instead of just eating low calorie ice cream, we could be actually filling ourselves with things that make us feel good.
Yeah, sure. And this is where I have some confusion, Tim and Josh, and I'd like, if we can, to clarify this. Josh, you have a sort of more of all of life approach to how we deal with health, and we shouldn't just think that if we eat, for example, lots of celery or celery juice, that somehow that's going to turn around our cancer. That's where you have a real problem with food as medicine. But at the same time, is it not true that long-time lifestyle changes for people with type 2 diabetes, where they eat less, not saying none, but less carbohydrate, lowering their blood sugar and thinking hard about what else they put in their mouths, could literally have a way of extending their life? So, you know, do you accept that as the science of changing a diet to improve health outcome, without saying that one particular food is medicine?
Yeah, certainly. I think it depends whether we want to go down the route of semantics, or whether we want to kind of talk about why that phrase itself has great potential for harm. As doctors, as healthcare professionals, full stop, everything that we deal with is a risk benefit, right? We look at what we're doing, what we're suggesting, and we go, well, we're suggesting it because this is the benefit here. And as long as the risk is less than that, then it seems like a potentially valid option, and we will weigh that up. When it comes to using the phrase food as medicine, you could argue semantics around the dictionary definition of medicine, but that's not the point. The point I'm making, or trying to make here, is that that kind of phrase causes people to get the wrong kind of view of what food is. And we can explain just how great food can be for us within our privilege, within our capacity, without taking it to an extent where, unfortunately, and this is something that happens an awful lot, people then start trying to manipulate their diet to cure things like chronic diseases, to cure acute illnesses. We've seen it a lot over the last year when it comes to spurious claims around boosting immunity when it comes to viral infections and COVID. Mm. We see it a lot in the hospital when it comes to people who have tried going down certain pathways after being diagnosed with cancer. And it's incredibly upsetting. And the vast majority of this stems from this belief that food can act like medicine. And there
Hence
is a
term
between
Nutribullets, which is where we began this conversation. I'm with you on that. Tim, can I just ask you about this? Do you feel like you're spending half your time as a nutritionist dispelling myths that might be promulgated in media or social media?
So I think that's part of the territory over some decades. The myths keep coming up. And rather than fight them all the time, I focus on whatever sort of positives that could be in terms of, you know, making someone eat better. Because no matter what the fads are, very few people are going keto or intermittent fasting, whatever it is, 6 months down the track. Eventually they start reverting back to their previous lifestyle. So it's really not sustainable. So I look at some positive behaviors anyone that can make, and if they're eating less highly processed food and just eating some more fruit and vegetables, that's a positive change. So while I still fight the fads, I focus on positive dietary changes people can make. And while we're speaking about food as medicine, I mean, food is certainly important in reducing the risk of chronic disease and treating it, but so too is exercise, not smoking, not, you know, not drinking a lot, having a good social network. All of those are our determinants of health, and we are very complex human beings. The idea that your green smoothie is going to cure cancer and get rid of your depression is simply fanciful.
Yeah. But at the same time, what we're talking here about the way people feel influenced by others, often without medical training, to change their behaviours. But at the same time, it's a fine line, is it not? Because you're also trying to change people's behaviours as doctors and nutritionists, because you know that over time, if you can remove risk factors like smoking and drinking from their lives, then that will have some long-term outcomes. So you're trying to say to people, what you're hearing on social media is bunkum, or in Josh's case, bollocks. But what we're telling you as medical professionals in terms of change in food, lifestyle and other risk factors is accredited. So it's very difficult, is it not, for lay people to hear those messages and go, well, why should I trust you over anyone else?
It's like saying, why would you trust your brain surgeon or your mechanic? You've got someone with expertise. They've got the track record of the scientific research, the qualifications. That does carry some gravitas and weight in any particular field. The thing is, the message of, hey, just eat, you know, eat more fruits and vegetables, get more active, you know, don't eat a lot of junk food, that's not going to sell, get lots of clicks on websites and sell books and get a lot of attention. You need to flip all that over and say the solution to obesity is this particular diet or this particular food. That gets interest and attention, and that's why the fads and the conflict and the noise in nutrition occurs so much, because of that. Because as a population, even though we've got good dietary guidelines, I mean, in Australia, a third of our calories each day comes from, you know, takeaway food. We're very inactive. Only 4% of people eat recommended serving of vegetables per day. So I've got the advice, it's actually implementing it and making it attractive to people is probably the biggest part of the problem.
Well, unfortunately, you two, we've run out of time. I mean, this could go literally for another couple of days, and we could also welcome in Justin Bieber, but we just haven't got the time for that. So I wanted to say thank you both very much indeed, because I think it's a conversation we need to keep debating around in terms of certainly people's post COVID outcomes on health and how they feel about themselves. Dr. Josh Woolrich is the NHS surgical doctor and author of Food Isn't Medicine, Challenging Nutribolics and Escape the Diet Trap. He actually did some nutrition training after his own medical training. And Dr. Tim Crow has been our other guest, accredited practicing dietitian and co-author of Understanding Nutrition, which is the leading text used in both Australia and New Zealand at the moment. You may have some thoughts on this as well. We'd love to hear from you. Erica Voles, I'm sensing you might have had some feedback.
Oh, there has been so much feedback, Michael. I won't be able to get through it all. One listener says, this is really positive. I cut out all sugar for 2 months and lost the 4 kilos I'd gained during lockdown. Another listener says, counting macros while ensuring you hit fiber targets works well. Make sure you get your fruit, vegetable, carbs, fat, protein, but in the right proportions. Now, I had to look up macros. Macro is short for macronutrient. Mm-hmm. So protein, carbohydrates and fats. Now, Michael, we have had many fans of fasting texting in. One listener says, my partner and I embarked on the Dr. Mosley's 5-2 diets. Tough going, but we lost 8 kilos each in just under 3 months. 2 kilos to go and we're free. Another listener says, I was diagnosed and had treatment for breast cancer 2 years ago. I don't count calories and have added rather than subtracted food. The subtraction comes naturally by feeling what is best for my body and my food preferences. Over 2 years, I've lost 20 kilos, but it's the internal health that I must focus on. Again, lots of people texting in about the benefits of fasting that they have appreciated. One listener is taking issue with Dr. Josh Woolrich. He says that Josh is out of his lane, Professor Ender's book, Gut. It scientifically proves that what we put in our gut makes a difference to our physical and mental health. But Les says to lose weight, move more, eat less, the rest is indeed bollocks.
I think we've all adopted that word for today. It's been brilliant. Erica Bowles, sure, thank you very much. And Erica back at, just after Too Hard Basket. This is Life Matters. The healing power of nature is something many of us swear by personally, and more studies are demonstrating its benefits for our minds and bodies. So is it something that can be happening more often in mental health settings? Erica Voles, who you've just heard from, has been looking into this. She's going to introduce us to a landscape gardener, a psychologist who's also a horticulturalist, and others who are exploring mindfulness practices and psychological therapy in gardens and in nature in general.
Hi, I'm Andrew Laidlaw and I'm the landscape architect at the Royal Botanic Gardens, Melbourne. So we've just come in from a bigger part of the gardens where the sky's bigger and the landscape is much more open, and we've just entered the first part of the fern gully. We're now moving into a much narrower path and we've got a lot more plants. You almost have to sort of slightly stoop to get in here.
Andrew is showing me some of the garden's meditation and memorial spaces. He's been designing and growing spaces like these in recent years, not just to be beautiful, but to include therapeutic and mindfulness benefits.
And then we're in the lovely little grotto garden. And the grotto garden is, as you can hear it, the water's just coming out of the stones. But the grotto has a symbolic connection to Christian belief, but it goes back to where people would go into the wilds and they'd often have a vision of Christ, or they'd go there for a spiritual cleansing. So we've used a grotto here, but it's more about the intimacy. It's more about being able to come into this space, being surrounded by plants, and just sit here quietly and become absorbed into the environment.
Tell me about when you're creating a space like this, the kinds of details that you hone in on that you're hoping the person sitting here, the observer, what they're going to take away from this space, and how that can end up being a therapeutic experience.
The idea is that they come through a threshold and then it slightly opens up and then they're completely wrapped and surrounded by plants. But it's very important that they feel safe. And quite often it's nice to have one, but sometimes two areas of being able to move in and out of these spaces. So the gesture of the space is to be loosely circular, but that it's wrapping around you in some ways. But the other thing that's really important is to make sure these gardens have got lots of love in them. And that's about having beautiful plant details that are looked after and cared for, and that these spaces are loved by the people that are in them, that look after them. And that brings a sort of a sense of well-being anyway.
Andrew shows me another of the meditation gardens, featuring water flowing up, out and over a stone.
I will find if I've had a difficult day, I will come to this garden because I find looking at that water is incredibly beautiful. And we've just got this water flowing over the rock, but I can just find that mesmerising, and that takes me into that sort of deep mindful place.
You've previously done some work with a psychologist and horticulturalist, Simon Lush. So it's interesting that psychologists are starting to look to nature for their work. Can you tell me about the garden that you helped Simon design at a psychology practice in Melton?
Sure. Well, he's done all of that really, but I probably just helped him try to define the spaces a little bit more. So to create these spaces where people could move into them, feel that sense of enclosure and being wrapped by plant material, and having a series of different spaces for people to move out of the inside space into these more nature-based spaces. And we also then looked at the car parking and just trying to create an atmosphere which is more a transition, I suppose, but where people come into a planted landscape, even if they drive into it, it says something about the care and the attention that they're going to get in that space, and it can really help them feel good about where they're going.
Hi, I'm Simon Lush. I'm a psychologist and a horticulturalist.
It's an interesting mix. Have you always been interested in both?
I have. Initially, I studied psychology, but the sort of threads of psychology and horticulture have sort of woven together. So I always bushwalked and kept productive gardens. So I sort of went to study at Burnley after finishing my degree, Burnley College, which has been a horticulture college, and it's been taken over recently by University of Melbourne, but then sort of came back to psychology and finished my study. And I've worked sort of in mindfulness type interventions with people for a long time. And just lately I've kind of started to focus back on gardens, back on sort of designing of gardens with a therapeutic benefit.
Noticing the birds in this area and a real feeling of light changing, clouds moving overhead, moving the light through the leaves of the trees.
Simon Lush leads a busy life, many of us do, but he tries to get out regularly into nature and just listen and be in the space.
and feeling different gusts of wind coming through, being quite calm.
Here's a bit of him doing that and sharing it with us.
Rise of different sounds and falling away. There's a feeling of things going on around me and I don't need to do anything, it's just happening around me. And feeling protected under this canopy of trees.
How do you actually build a garden that is soothing for the mind, that has a benefit psychologically?
There's emerging research, a lot of that kind of happening over in Scandinavia at the moment and other places as well. But kind of going back to this idea of the evolutionary connection between our kind of calming, restorative states and certain environments. And so there's an emphasis in a lot of these spaces that there's a certain element of wildness, there's a certain element of being kind of away in nature. There's legibility in that landscape as well. You know, there's a sense of protection, there's a sense of refuge.
In addition to designing the garden at Melton, Simon has also used the garden as the teaching space for a mindfulness course.
So we use that space to do some basic sort of exercises where we sort of tune the senses, folded in some horticulture practices and gardens into that mindfulness focus. There was some sketching, we used magnifying glasses, just kind of stoking that kind of curiosity to slow down in that environment. We also branched out into the Melton Botanic Gardens and did some exercises in that space as well.
How did everyone respond to this 8-week course? Did you have high hopes? Did you have low expectations? How did it go?
I was really surprised, you know, in terms of the horticulture and the garden. That was really prized. That was a really valuable experience, it seemed like. And everyone commented on that element. You know, that was really something that they intended to take with them, to have more time, you know, on the way to work, you know, walking through parks, spending time in the garden.
We started off small and that was a bit about just slowing down and just taking in all the smells and the sounds and everything like that.
A couple of years back, Jason Wells took part in the course run by Simon Lush.
Even if it was just to pick a square metre that you're in and really, you know, just take note of what's actually going on in the garden around you.
Jason spends quite a bit of time in nature, fishing, bushwalking, even bow hunting. But at the time of doing the course, he was dealing with depression and PTSD, and some of that was linked to his fairly stressful job. In fact, Jason was off work. He wanted to do more than just see doctors and counsellors. He says the course opened up new approaches to nature for him. He talked about one activity that they did at the Melton Botanical Gardens.
One of the things that Simon got us to do was sort of go on like an ultra slow walk through a little path and just really sort of taking your time and going as slow as possible, which, you know, in this day and age is something that we really don't do and is against the sort of programming a little bit. But yeah, I found that really good just to, you know, take a closer look and in detail of what's around us, you know, from the patterns on the leaves to, you know, flowers and then the sounds and the different layers of sounds where you've got, you know, the things that are closer and stuff like that, but then also then the noises coming through in the background and in the distance and that sort of thing. It has helped me just absorb more while I'm in nature, so I guess, you know, being out there and that sort of stuff was always something that did make me feel better, but I think I'm able to absorb a little bit more from that because just being more aware and appreciate just everything that's around me and going on, and maybe look at things a bit more positively as well, whether you might get caught out in the rain and that sort of stuff, and instead of, you know, being, oh no, I'm stuck in the rain, I'm getting wet, like, it's instead enjoy the moment of feeling the rain on your skin and, you know, the cool breeze, you know, and all that sort of stuff.
And now Jason is back at work.
Yeah, I've been a prison officer for just over 14 years now, working maximum security. So I've definitely, it could catch up with you. And I definitely think the mindfulness, it helped me, and especially the being out in nature and then applying that mindfulness there, it sort of helped calm me from the inside out, if that makes any sense. And I've been back to work for a while now, full time and that sort of thing. I have taken a step back from my role that I was in just to try ease back into things a little bit. But it's definitely, I think the mindfulness has helped me continue along and, be a bit happier in life and just deal with stresses and, anxiety and things like that when it comes up a little bit better than I was before.
So, hi, my name's Angelo Pagano. I'm a psychologist in Melton South, and I'm sitting in a garden that Simon Lush designed, who is also a psychologist and horticulturalist.
So describe for me the garden. What's it like?
It's really beautiful. He's created a range of spaces within a front garden, which sits in front of an old Californian bungalow. It has three or four different spaces. So in one of the spaces, we've got he's designed a children's garden. In the other space, there's a small meeting space where staff and clients sit at different times, of course. There's another space he's created, which is like an orchard with some raised beds, some vegetable and herb beds.
And so when it comes to clients using the space, how does it tend to happen? Do you have clients that decide that they want to sit outside for their consultation rather than in a consulting room?
Some clients will talk about the garden setting. If they want to, they're enabled to use the spaces in the garden. Sometimes children are using the garden with their psychologist. It seems to happen fairly organically.
What impact does having a client being outside in nature have on the way the consultation will go, and how does it change the consultation?
I think for the client who likes a garden space or likes to be in nature, it's a really good way to reduce anxiety. I've had clients who've experienced significant trauma who find that they're able to feel calmer and able to use the garden as a way of settling themselves down. So I think it's a great alternative to using an internal space. So some people who are somewhat claustrophobic or anxious in small spaces find the garden a really helpful alternative.
But Angela, I guess it's not going to work for everyone. I imagine some people might feel that others could potentially overhear their consultation. Is it fair to say that there are going to be some people who are going to be like, no, four walls for me, thank you?
Precisely. It's another option. I think we treat the garden as a tenth room. So the primary work we do is within the four walls.
When you set it up, I guess, in that kind of conducive space of a natural environment, it really just kind of gives it that extra impetus for people to really kind of have a deep experience of that, really feel it. When someone's diagnosed with depression or anxiety, they're coming from, a fairly exhausted starting position. So a little bit of help goes a long way. So I think it's a really promising area, and I think that there'll be more of it as the evidence emerges.
Recently, Simon Lush moved north with his family to the Sunshine Coast in Queensland. He's adjusting to the new ecosystem.
I feel kind of like I'm in Mars a lot of the time. There are similarities to Victoria in some ways, but I miss the grasslands of Victoria. It's a very conducive environment up here, and things grow so quickly, and that sort of sense of forest is all around, which is a very conducive space for a lot of these kind of activities and mindfulness. So my idea is to purchase some land. I'm looking at the moment, and obviously have that as my own refuge, but to have these similar individual and group activities that are facilitated in that space. So that's the dream at this point.
But we can all just have a crack at gaining the benefits of nature. I'm back at the Botanical Gardens in Melbourne. Andrew Laidlaw and I are going to try a mindfulness exercise. It involves closing our eyes, tuning into our senses, and really pushing our feet into the ground to feel the earth and becoming aware of gravity coursing through our bodies.
And now look around you and notice what you can see and hear, and notice where you are and what you're doing. So how are you feeling?
It's good. I really enjoyed that. I mean, we're standing at the base of this beautiful ficus, so I think I connected to the earth, and it, you know, it's amazing to be mindful that the earth is a living thing. The soil, the earth, that tree. The interesting to put your feel a bit of pressure in your legs, because that draws your mind into your legs a little bit, which I then think draws it and transfers it down into the earth. So no, that was good. It was very mindful.
And the rain is coming down now.
The rain is coming down.
Normally I'd be a bit irked, but it actually kind of feels pretty nice. Thanks, Andrew.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks, Erica.
The psychological therapy, the power of being in a vegetated world. That was Andrew Laidlaw finishing that report there from Erica Vowles, a beautiful piece. And hopefully it gave your Friday morning a nice sense of focus and at the same time tranquility. You can find out more information about all of the guests in that story from Erica by heading to the Life Matters homepage.
Got an issue you just can't fix? On the fence about what direction you should take? Been wrestling with a situation that's out of control? Let's take it out of the too hard basket.
And this one that we're taking out of the too hard basket for today is from Melissa. And Melissa writes to us and says, every Friday, I take my 10-year-old daughter for her swimming lesson. We arrive 45 minutes before her lesson so we can play together. We have a beach ball that we play a kind of water volleyball with in the hydro pool, and we have so much fun. However, this fun is being interrupted by a young boy and his even younger sister, both who attend my daughter's school. They come in the pool and they want to join in. And we're both unhappy, says Melissa, as we feel obliged to let them play as well. With the children playing with my daughter, it relinquishes the responsibility on the parents, as now I'm looking after their children. They're happily free to concentrate on their phones and no longer watch their kids. In addition, the boy doesn't play fair and hogs the ball. The girl takes the ball off to the side of the pool as she feels left out, and my daughter is unhappy because we aren't playing together. After being through chemotherapy, writes Melissa, and recovery, I have vowed to play all the more with my children. I miss out on laughing and doing silly things with my daughter. I want to say no to the children, but I am afraid that I would sound petty to the parents. So what do I do? How would you handle Melissa's pool dilemma? If you have some thoughts, you can leave a post and a comment on the RN Facebook page. Or text me right now on 0418 226 576. On the ball for this one, we have a lovely pool of people, two really. Denise Erickson, co-founder of Media Mentors, and creative entrepreneur, filmmaker and home dad, Justin Bechtold. And Justin, Denise, hello, lovely to have you back
hello.
On the radio.
Hello, lovely to talk to you both.
Justin, hi Michael, hi Denise.
And hi. Justin, I'll come to you in a moment. Denise, what was your initial reaction when you read this scenario?
Well, you know, when you get these scenarios, you do a bit of a skim read and you go, oh, for goodness sake, get over yourself. And then I read it properly. And I can feel for Melissa because my much-loved daughter-in-law had breast cancer a couple of years ago. And one of the effects afterwards is the desperation to connect again. Well, not to physically connect again with your children is really powerful. Mm. So I totally understand her desire to, you know, play with her child uninterrupted. So actually I ended up feeling a lot more sympathetic and trying to come up with solutions instead of just being, oh, for goodness sake, it's a public pool, which isn't very nice.
Well, I'm glad to hear you went through a little bit of a journey there on your own sort of sense of tact around this, Denise. And that's good, because often the devil is in the detail and the nuances of these little stories that come to us as part of Too Hard Basket. Yeah. And Justin, what about yourself? Do you have a perspective on Melissa's pool dilemma?
Yeah, well, certainly, you know, time is precious with kids. You know, you only got kids for so long, and I think, you know, spending quality time with your kids is important, not just to you as a parent, but also to the child as well. So I think it's, you know, it's a really important issue, I think.
You've been the playful dad in social gatherings of children, haven't you?
Oh, absolutely. My family motto is keep it fun. So, everything we do, we always apply some kind of element of fun to, you know, whatever it is that we do.
And in so doing, Justin, do you find that if you're in a social gathering with people, with other families, other kids, and kids are drawn into that play, that it's a natural reaction perhaps from parents to go, well, that's taken care of then, I can move away and I'll let that adult over there deal with all the distractions and demands?
You know, that happens to me all the time, especially because when I'm like dropping kids off at school, I'm like the first person to see, you know, like initiate a game of Tiggy or something with the kids. So there'll be like, you know, 20 or 30 kids all just running around, you know, chasing each other and playing hide and seek or whatever. And the parents are often like, just brush their hands off and they're like, oh, yeah, Justin's got them. Let's not worry about them now. We'll just go back to our phones or our conversations.
I think it's time you started charging them an hourly rate.
It off to someone else.
Just charge them an hourly rate, Justin. I think that's the only way forward from now on. Denise, you've taken your own grandchild, I think, who's 5 years old, to swimming lessons. How did that go?
Well, look, I love taking her out into things like swimming lessons. And I'm one of those people that, like, if I see a group of kids playing that are usually, you know, going to be connected to the activity that she's about to join, I'm one of the ones going, oh, why don't you go and play with them? Partly because she's an only child, but also she's incredibly sociable. So, and it's not so that, I mean, I'm like a hawk still, particularly around swimming pools. I mean, I'm never just going to go and nick off and play with my phone because I'd be terrified that something would happen to her. But I think, like, I love the idea of her joining into groups of activities. So I'm one of those ones who go, oh, God, do you want to go and have a play with, you know, Melissa's daughter? Because you know her from school, so off you go. And it wouldn't occur to me to think, oh, my God, that could be a problem. So I think that, you know, it is something that Melissa has. It's a very different situation to the norm in the sense that she's brought her child there to have a game with the beach ball and she doesn't want interference from other kids. And I think that's fair enough. But I do think that there's ways she could get around it and still, you know, without upsetting anybody.
Yeah. What are you suggesting?
Well, one of the things I thought, to bring a spare beach ball and just give it to the other kids and tell them to nick off and play their own game, point one. She could also chat to the kids and say, look, she and her daughter really want to play together for a while, but how about we give you a shout 10 minutes before class and you can join in then? That's assuming the kids are in the same class. I mean, I just, like, if all else fails, then I probably would talk to the parents and say, look, just so that you understand, I've been through this awful treatment recently and I'm really trying to, you know, just have a bit of more time one-on-one with my daughter. Would you mind if the kids don't join us in these games? But she may find that by just saying to the kids, I mean, my granddaughter's very astute and if she's told to go play somewhere else, she's quite happy to. So I think that I don't think it's necessarily going to be a huge issue, but it's something that Melissa will have to sort of take some decisions about and put into action, I think.
Well, clearly, because, I mean, you know, Melissa is obviously feeling quite conflicted about this. And as someone, as you say, who's gone through cancer treatment and now wants to spend as much time intensively with her children because she realises that is of value to herself and her children too. And her daughter is seemingly unhappy about the two other kids getting involved. Maybe this is the kind of thing that needs to happen. And I think, Justin, you said something about time out maybe from the two other children initially before they join in.
Yeah, I think I agree with Denise. You know, you could give them like a, just give them another, you know, 10-minute warning. So, you know, just give us 10 minutes to ourselves and we can join in. Or there's other things where you can do where you can just simply explain, like, listen, you know, I know you guys want to join in, but today we're just having some special mummy and daughter time, you know, so maybe next week, you know, we could play together. I think, you know, kids really respond to that. They understand the importance of that, you know, mummy daughter time or daddy son time or whatever it is. So, you know, kids really understand that kind of dynamic. And or the other option is to, you know, like set up teams, you know, and swap teams, and, you know, or give them special rules and stuff about the game. You know, like, yeah, we can play, but you can only, you know, hold the ball for 5 seconds before you got to tap it away or whatever. You know, you can create different rules around those games.
I think at the heart of this is that Melissa really doesn't, and I understand why, that doesn't want those kids playing because of the fundamental reason. So I think that, you know, if she's not able to compromise on that position, and as I say, I'm not being judgmental about it at all, then she has to be quite firm with kids. And I mean, I don't know. I think sometimes that maybe it's because I'm a grandparent and so therefore I'm going around this for the second time. Maybe sometimes we turn it into a bigger issue than it actually is. You know, just say to the kids, look, sorry, mate, I'm playing with my daughter here. You know, nick off you go. See you later. you know, and I mean, I've said that sort of stuff in the, you know, kids in the park, you know, and they just sort of look at you as if you're like some old bat being a grandmother and go away. And I just think that it's actually maybe not as big a thing as Melissa is feeling that it is. And I can see why she's feeling that, but actually just say, look, sorry, kids, we're busy. See you in class.
Look, I think as we come to an end on this, Justin and also Denise, I think there's a couple of strategies here. Either distract or be honest with the children about what other times are available, but not right now. And of course, one of the areas that Facebook comments are focused on is talking to the parents as well. But that can be a difficult thing because you don't know who the parents are and you don't know how they're going to react. And, you know, that I can see why that might be a suggestion, but it also can be a little confronting for people. But I think with a mixture of distraction and just plain honesty, maybe, you know, Melissa will get the space she needs with her daughter and everyone will come away without feeling too compromised. And I do thank you both very much for these insights as parents and grandparents into how to deal with these situations in a public pool. So thanks again to co-founder of Media Mentors, Denise Erickson. Denise, talk to you soon.
You will. Lovely to talk to you both again.
And Justin Bechtold, talk to you soon as well.
No worries. There is a quick final option I could offer.
Quick?
That's as a final resort, you could always pull a Caddyshack, drop a polywaffle into the pool, and you might have to end up clearing the entire pool, but at least you'll probably end up with it to yourselves.
And on that tasteful bombshell from Justin Bechtold, if you have an issue you would like to resolve in the Two Heart Basket, just send it to us at lifematters@abc.net.au and put Two Heart Basket in the header and we'll do our best to discuss it for you. Thank you both very much. Erica Voles, what do you got?
Lots of reflections. Ruth writes, women have always been taught that we must defer to others and put our feelings above everyone else's feelings above our own. This is not true. It would be perfectly fine to say to the other children's parents, this is my special time with my daughter. So please tell your children that they can't join us. Lots of other reflections agreeing. One listener says, simply ask the parents and be strong. This is ridiculous. But look, that sounds reasonable. Not everyone is okay with conflict. And look, Michael, a couple of reflections about our story on mindfulness psychology and therapeutic gardens.
Yeah.
Georgina says, the Melbourne Botanic Gardens meditative spaces. I visited these spaces last Monday. What a wonderful addition to the gardens. I was soothed at a time of great stress. And Michael, there'll be a lot more comments heading to the Monday mailbox.
I have no doubt. Erica Voles, thank you very much. And a big shout out to all of the Life Matters team for their enormous effort this week. Hilary Harper is back next week. I am too. We'll talk to you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.